Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bond Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the panel interpreter and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey, what's what?
Chris Casso.
Hey.
And Nicole Lamb.
Wait, what? We're recording?
Wait, what? Well, how is everybody this fine evening? Into the darkest of nights we roll.
Yeah, we're into the wee hours now.
We're all a little tired and punchy. It's muggy here in Seattle right now.
But we're kind of okay in here right now.
But we've spent muggier nights.
Which is miraculous,
here.
I'm sure.
Yeah. It's been a not unpleasant summer. We've had our heats, but it's not been. And we didn't have the smoke season.
I bought a
season.
New bathing suit. And there has been no beach day since then. Well, so the ghost ruined it for everybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We've spent some, because we had some intense panel jumper shoots here. We spent some pretty muggy nights in this shop.
Yeah, I blame those halogen lights.
It's because we had some hot guys in here.
Yeah, we did.
Raise that temperature.
Yeah. Anyway, C.B. Sapolsky said something accidentally on a call, and comicbookresources.com just wrote a whole article on it. He's talking about the rivalry that does not exist between Marvel and DC as it once did back in the, I don't know, the day. And he's talking about how sometimes there's Marvel and DC have sort of the same type of storylines, maybe the same types of characters. And he says, there's some natural crossover, and I don't... Well, that's a bad word. We're not doing a Marvel-DC crossover. That's a Sobolsky laugh. There's some natural storylines that have... that kind of has similarities in them that just come naturally because we tell stories about the world outside our window. That's a very Marvel thing to do.
Synchronicity.
Creative synchronicity.
Anyway, so Marvel and DC are pals, they're chums, but they're not going to be any crossovers anytime soon. Well,
it's sitting at home on my bookshelf, but I picked up a book called Slugfest that is about the history of DC Marvel animosity. And I do feel like I haven't read it yet, couldn't tell you the name of the author, but. No, that animosity has existed since the inception.
I feel like it's like DC is like, okay, we're doing like a zombie thing with like Batman. It's called Deceased. I'm going to just call my guy here. Hey, Marvel. we're doing zombies. And they're like, oh, cool. Yeah, we're totally good on that. Cool, thanks.
Yep.
And then like 3 months later, Contagion by Marvel Comics. It's like, okay, whatever.
See, I feel that both... So the Marvel people are just too nervous because the mouse is breathing down their neck. And the Time Warner people are too nervous because they don't know if they're going to have jobs for much longer.
Right.
Yep. So I think like the animosity... So he's not quite at the front of the burner.
It's a panic now.
Well, now they're owned by corporations. Before, they were their own. I mean, well, they were always owned by overseers,
sure.
but they weren't, or they were managed by overseers.
But they didn't have as large bankrolls behind them.
Thank you.
So it's more of a desperate need to try to hang on for dear life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the haggling over Jack Kirby. It's like, so there was that, there was that sort of thing. And there's always been borrowed ideas or shared ideas.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of the beast. Part of it's the zeitgeist. Part of it's like, that's part of it's just marketing. It's like, that concept is selling pretty well over there. Let's try it over here.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just kind of in the nature of the beast. Actually, Please, no more crossovers. No, that's just a really bad idea.
But with that being said, who will win, Iron Man or Batman?
Batman.
Well, Batman.
It was.
Wait, does he have time to prepare, guys? Sorry.
It was the amalgam stuff that I just like. I can't believe I spent all that money on all that amalgam crap when they merged.
There's a couple fun ones out of there.
Yeah, but okay, please tell me which ones you thought were fun.
Super Spider Boy and the Legion of Superheroes.
Okay, that was fun.
Yeah.
But I mean, they just missed the mark on so many things. It's like Man Thing and
they turned it into like Bat Thing. Bat Thing and turned into Man Bat Pear Pig. I don't know.
Yeah, it was
Bat Man Thing.
Bat Thing. It was Bat Thing.
I mean, when it should have just been Man Thing and Swamp Thing, and they should have called it Thing.
Thing.
It would have been fun. But you are a bunch of humorless gits.
Anyway, speaking of humorless gits, let's check in with the Stumblebound crew and see what's going on. I'm sure it's terrible.
No, that's a good transition
right now.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Stumblebound Podcast. This is a what would you call it? A sort of sub-podcast within the whole Perfect Bound umbrella, which lives within the Panel Jumper universe.
It hides within the chest of the main podcast and bursts forth at some point.
We make a bunch of jokes about... Thank you for listening to the Whatever Podcast. This is actually one of those.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I'm here with my good friends, Cole.
Hi.
Chris.
Hello.
And Webster.
Hi.
Thank you all for joining us. And today we're sipping on a nice Summerfest crisp lager from Sierra Nevada, one of the first true
Webster,
craft
Webster, we were
brews.
Supposed to move on to the other beer. We didn't.
Slow pokes.
Cole and Webster are still sipping on the beer from the last episode, yeah. But Chris and I have moved on to the Summerfest. It's
5%?
5%. It's middle ground. Yeah.
Last one was 8%.
The last one was 8.2, yes. And the one before that was like a
4.2.
That was whiskey.
It was whiskey.
Everything before that was whiskey, which is like 50 proof. Hey!
Oh.
Cheers. All right.
I can't be in the club.
Clinkies. Clinkies. There we go. All right. I have nothing clever to say at the beginning of this one. I have put bottle caps on Optimus Prime's and Ultra Magnus's head.
There we go.
They look like party hats.
You're a Philistine. You have no respect.
This is, of course, the show where we get out of our comfort zone, out of our safe place, and drink while we do the show and talk about comic books. So let's talk about comic books, friends. And one of the things
what the heck was that?
Don't edit that out.
Last time we had a Perfect Bound podcast, I mentioned my friend Dan. And one of the reasons Dan loves this is because we don't edit out the places where we drop bottle caps on the ground or belch into the microphone. He thinks it's funny, and I think it's, you know, I just don't like having extra work to do when I edit that. So it's a win-win.
Yes.
Well, bless you, Dan.
Alan Moore says he's going to retire again. What do we think about that, friends?
He's running out of lawns to scream children from.
yesterday.
I think that it's just... But he said this before, though.
He has retired so many times.
Right. And I don't know why he bothers to be public about when he goes through these different creative lulls because he never stops creating, and he's been writing prose as long as he's been writing comics but I think he said that the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen series, the current one called Tempest, will be his swan song, which is all well and good, but it's so freaking postmodern and experimental that I'm having a terrible time actually finishing reading the latest issue.
I read the first one.
Yep.
I enjoyed it.
Yep.
But then I've developed a really weird system of surviving the amount of books that come out this week, this store, because so much comes out now. We're drowning in it. So if I read something and I'm like, that was good, my brain says, you don't have to read it ever again until it's finished.
Oh, wow.
And then maybe later. Because there's so many other things.
Yeah.
And I have to have a vague idea if it's worth ordering or if it's worth recommending.
Okay.
So I read the first one. I'm like, this is exactly like the other leagues. I will like this when it's done.
Terribly, terribly esoteric.
Yep.
Rewards literary nerds or lit nerds
and pulp fiction nerds and every nerd in between.
But this one, the latest one, I mean, I don't think he puts footnotes in them, but this one I had to go look up characters. I mean, in this one he makes references to, you know, the island and the yellow submarine and its literature and pop culture and all kinds of stuff mishmashed. I don't know what the point of the story is, if there's ever a point in the story for these at all.
I think it's his happy place.
It is. I think you're absolutely right. I think he's at this point, he's writing these stories for him and maybe a couple other people.
Yeah.
And trying to keep up with what he's doing is really challenging for me, because also there's so much UK culture, pop culture stuff in it anymore as well.
That I'm not entirely sure what it's referring to, but then every once in a while there's a bit for me that I'm like, I know he was referring to.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And you know, but that's his way. So I think it's okay for him to, I mean, I don't have any issues with whatever he does anymore. He's contributed a lot. People, I feel very strongly that for the most part, people don't appreciate what he's done and it's sad that they've misinterpreted what he's tried to do with his storytelling. And, you know, it's just one more indication of the dumbing of America, as far as I'm concerned. But.
Somebody who's not retiring is Ed Brubaker. We talked about him recently.
And maybe, Ed, you should
segue.
He's inked an overall deal with Legendary, which means basically they're giving him free reign to create stuff.
Hmm.
He signed a multi-year overall deal with Legendary Television Studios, which is the same television studio which is producing Paper Girls for Amazon and Neil Gaiman. He will adapt as well as collaborate with fellow television creators in the adaptation of some of his most iconic creator-owned properties. Additionally, he will develop original content for Legendary. This article from Deadline.com from July of 2019 does not say which of his properties he's going to adapt. But what should he adapt? What should Ed Brubaker bring to TV?
So the Criminal series, yep, which is what he's kind of most popular for in general, every single volume is its own self-contained movie. They just happen to take place in the same world, but there's no real crossover, except like they all go to the same bar. I think that's a really cool idea.
And they're all grim and gritty noir style.
Pure
stories.
Noir, yeah.
I was fascinated by Fade Out, and I think Fade Out, because of the rise of Lovecraftian interest in body horror. I only read like the first two.
That's fatal. Fade Out is the 1940s Hollywood one.
I'm sorry, it's also The Fade Out. Oh.
Wait. Sorry. Fatal.
Fatal is the one with the Lovecraftian themes.
Yes.
Yes.
But what happens in Fade Out? That's just the murder story.
Fade Out's just a murder story, but in like 1940s Hollywood.
Thank you. Got it. Okay.
We would have gotten letters.
No. Yeah. But they both are set in...
They're all crime noir.
They're all crime noir, but aren't they both set in Hollywood?
I didn't think Fatal was. I can't remember, though.
She's an entertainer. I thought she was a movie star, too.
Hmm.
Well, of course, this is the problem with Brubaker, is that he's got stock characters that he uses and uses and uses.
Yeah.
But you're right. Fatal is the one. She is a femme fatale, and she indiscriminately or discriminately kills her lovers because she's got a demon in her.
Well, couldn't there conceivably be some sort of a multi-story crossover in this television series?
Well, Brubakerverse,
the Brubaker Cinematic Universe.
It just happened in my brain, so yes.
Yes, yeah. Incognito is another one of his titles that has sold millions. Yeah. Kill or Be Killed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, they're all basically tailor-made to be TV shows at some point.
Yep.
Which is another sort of topic of a conversation where... television studios just kind of look to the comic book market to get content, but then do comic book creators write comic books with the intent of selling them to TV shows?
Some definitely do.
Yeah,
there was an entire publishing company called Virgin that was based to do that. They ended up doing like, here's John Woo and Garth Ennis doing a comic together or something like that.
Well, the Wachowskis had their own comic book company for a while.
Basically, did they have that before doing movie stuff?
No, way after doing
way movies. After.
Well, I mean, the Wachowskis basically created, from what I understand, and I could be getting this completely wrong, and readers, write in, let me know if I'm getting this wrong, but they created their comic book publishing company to basically make Matrix comics that connected the movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Fleshed out the movies.
And then it just kept on going.
Yeah. Yep. But they had some other kind of interesting properties. Didn't they have the Frankenstein?
Doc Frankenstein.
Which was really fun.
And they also had...
Shaolin Cowboy.
Yeah. Cowboy Cowboy.
Yeah.
Shaolin Cowboy.
And the thing is, three times fast.
Both of the creators on those did storyboards for The Matrix. The giant tentacle robots in The Matrix were designed by Steve Scrosi, who did Doc Frankenstein.
Yes.
So I think this is a good question. Like, on the same topic, like, are people writing specifically for a cinematic kind of version or. You know, it just happened that way. You know, one of the descriptive terms that I've heard several years is like, oh, this comic book is so cinematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much of that is in the writing and how much of that is up to the artist? Like being influenced by cinema coming to the full, you know, like you know, school, like, we did not even used to study cinema. There was no schools. It wasn't even, like, seen as an academic thing until, what, the 70s,
right.
which mm-hmm. they actually created film schools.
Right.
So, you know, having that kind of reflection and that kind of visual, you know, language. I guess, influence and language.
Yep. So in the early 2000s, Warren Ellis basically coined the term cinematic comics. Huh. And with the proliferation of The Authority and The Ultimates and Mark Millar, that was the exploration of making comics that felt like a movie. Mm-hmm. Everything was widescreen.
Yep.
Yeah. And so when you say widescreen, does that just mean like more splash pages or?
More splash pages.
No, more depth of field in the images. There's more happening.
Yep.
Go back and read some Joe Dorowsky. I don't know. Oh, yeah. I feel like that stuff is very cinematic.
Oh, it was there, but,
yeah,
no, but he, mainstream but he was... versus mainstream versus European.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
No, he was. No, he had that vision long before American filmmakers had it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't he tapped for Dune or whatever?
Dorowski's Dune is a great...
I just rewatched that documentary last week because I'm like, I want to see that again because I know there's stuff I missed. If you've not seen the documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune, you owe it to yourself to see it because it's insane.
Yeah.
I have a massive, you know, the tabletop art books, like Jodorowsky. Yeah. Like,
yep.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And there's a reason why he had a whole line of comic books that he wrote and co-created with Mobius and whatnot.
The Jodoverse.
The Jodoverse. The Humanoid Press stuff. Is that right?
Yep.
Netflix, buy it, make it.
No, somebody has. That's all.
Oh, have they?
Oh, yeah. But he's a madman and he had a rare vision for storytelling and he knew that comic books were the crux of it.
You say this past tense, he's alive and still doing
Well, I don't know if he's still making movies, though.
He did one
he's
like a year or two ago.
Weird. Okay. I think that we can all agree that he's still being weird. Yeah.
That man is absorbed so many
but
drugs.
He's definitely writing comic books.
Yes.
Yeah, because he's that's what I didn't know about him is that he was writing so many comic books and he'd created all of these or co-created all these comic book universes.
Yeah, Chris, I love Chris pointed me in the direction of all the Jodorowsky comic books and they're on my shelf and I love them. They're fantastic.
So it's also something to recognize is that many of our favorite comic book artists from the 70s and 80s, they weren't making much money writing comics, but they went to Hollywood and started storyboarding.
Yeah.
And I'll probably review it on the next PBP, but I bought the second volume of Art of Mike Plogue.
Oh.
And that has even more storyboards from The Thing, from Dark Crystal, from all these films. Like, oh, wow, I didn't know he storyboarded that. And you look at his storyboards and, like, they are frame for frame what wound up on screen.
Yeah. The point of a storyboard.
Just even down to the design work.
No, storyboard artists are the unsung heroes of Hollywood.
But how often have you seen storyboards that are just kind of rough sketches of where the camera angle is going to be? These were he had the set designs, he had the costumes, he had the everything.
I hear that the storyboard artist for Mad Max, Fury Road, has a writing credit on the movie because
enough of
he
it.
Plotted the film. So in the stand-up comedy world. Traditional stand-ups look down upon those stand-ups who are only getting into stand-up to further their acting career. Is there the same sort of stigma in the comic book world? Like if some comic comes out, like let's say Brian K. Vaughan comes out with a comic and it's obviously just something that he wants to make into a movie, but he doesn't have a movie deal, so he just makes a comic. A of all, is that recognized? I'm not singling out Brian K. Vaughan specifically, but for anybody, is that recognized? B of all, is there a different kind of, does the industry like, or consumers look down upon that kind of thing?
I don't believe so. I can't speak as far as the creative side.
Yeah.
But there's never felt like there's been that kind of division. Also, you have to take into account the large corporate heads. So, what's his name? J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
He's doing a Spider-Man comic with his son.
No.
His son wrote it.
No.
And it's one
How
of those things.
Son?
a young Sprague is what he is. So, it's one of those things where it's just kind of like, yeah, okay, this is
It's kind of nepotism. Mm-hmm. But nobody really says much negative online. And definitely Disney's like, nobody say anything bad.
Which is weird because online is where people say negative things.
Right.
And I'm sure there are plenty of people who have said bad things. I've seen some YouTube channels that have. But it's still just in general, I don't feel like there's that much of a negative vibe.
Okay.
Well, you know, let's go back to The Rocketeer, though. Ben reviewed The Rocketeer a couple weeks ago when he discovered the reprint volume.
Yeah.
And Dave Stevens was a visual storytelling genius.
A storyboard artist.
And right. But he created The Rocketeer comic to pitch his movie.
Is that so?
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Oh, I thought I mentioned that. Yeah, he never had any.
Listen to the show.
Beer.
Beg your pardon?
Beer is happening.
Oh, that's a great endorsement for the show, man. Yeah. I don't listen
anyway,
to this.
Anyway, I do listen to the show because I have to edit it. Anyway, keep going.
And that was actually very disheartening to hear because I loved the visuals for that comic book so much, and I was actually I was nerd rewarded by what he was doing in it and the film references and everything. But to learn that he was not passionate about making a comic book, he was passionate about making his comic book property a film.
Yeah.
And that kind of changed my whole attitude about it. And the Rocketeer film is a fine little film. It's very dated, but it was not a blockbuster.
Oh.
It was not a blockbuster, and it's far from, and it does not follow the comic book very closely in a lot of aspects.
Who plays the Betty Page character?
That's Jennifer Connelly.
Jennifer Connelly.
So I love that movie.
And they don't call her Betty, they call her Jenny, right?
Yeah, I think so. But it's got Jennifer Connelly, so I'm down with it.
Yeah, and they kind of pull back from the Betty Page aspect. She's not a sex pot.
Well, it was
Timothy Dalton's the villain.
Yeah,
it was a bad guy. Family friendly film.
It was
non Betty Page aspect. Let's be for real.
So Dave got to make his Rocketeer movie, but he didn't get any other properties off the ground, and I think he went back to trying to sell the comic book again. And he had several other properties that he pitched, and there were some wonderful teaser images of other comic books he was supposedly going to be rolling out that he never did, because his passion was not in making comic books.
That was obvious when it came to the word bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't know how to make comics.
Hard to follow.
He's a brilliant illustrator, but he really didn't know how to make comics. And I don't think he took a lot of guidance from. He didn't welcome a lot of guidance from other people.
Yeah.
Well, I have a hard this argument for me: movie, comic book, TV show, whatever. You know, I'm a fan of a good story,
right?
In whatever format that presents itself to me, you know. So, in that respect, yeah, sorry, Chris.
No, you're good.
Is he broken?
No.
I was so I was for those of you listening. I was actually trying to transform
Jetfire,
and stop because I didn't want to break it, and I didn't know what it was doing.
All good.
And Chris is like poking things that I may or may not have moved. So anyway,
back did to it wrong. What you're saying?
That's why
Webster.
I stopped. What I'm saying is that whether or not. Whatever end vision you see your story coming out in, I personally appreciate the journey of getting your story out there in whatever form you can. And, you know, for me, I don't know if people are aware of the adaptation theory and things like that. Every new kind, so super, super dumbed down version of the adaptation theory is every version of the story, no matter what the original was, exist at its own level, right? So if there's a book and then it becomes a movie, mm-hmm. that's an adaptation, but yet the movie exists as its own piece of work.
Right.
Whereas mm-hmm. in same thing with comic book and things like that.
Right.
So the idea is each iteration of that story is its own story.
Okay.
So I don't have any problem with that, whether people have the intention of having it made into a movie or into a TV show. Or whether or not they're like, oh, man, I really love comics. I want to make this comic. Oh, I guess I'll sell it to a TV show. And then executive produce and then complain about it and blah, blah, blah. Or whatever. I'm a fan of storytelling. I just want a really good story.
Mm-hmm.
However that presents itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Chris was saying, I don't think fans are complaining at all. You know, they're not oh, this is so cinematic.
Yeah, I don't think I... like my original argument was that it was stand-up professionals who look down on other upcoming stand-ups who want to who pursue a stand-up career only to sell their movie. Hmm. Now, audiences don't care. As long as you're funny, who cares what your ambitions are? You're
product
funny in the moment.
Versus process.
So consumers of comic books, they don't care if you create a comic book solely to make a movie. Like for Rocketeer, people didn't buy the Rocketeer because Dave just wants to make a movie. I'm just gonna wait for the movie.
Right. Yep.
You know, it's I guess other industry professionals. So I guess it's a question that couldn't really be answered unless we are, you know, mm-hmm. have an inside line to like what Alan Moore thinks of, you know, whatever random comic is out there that wants to be a movie.
But I think it says something about how visual storytelling has been shaped in comics. Because we do talk about cinematic imagery and flow in comics now in ways we didn't before. And yeah, I think comics have to, for a comic book, a mainstream comic book to be a success, it has to look like a movie. It has to have that depth of field. It has to have a lot of pop in it. I mean, look at the popular comic books now versus the comic books from the 90s. And how the absence of dialogue, the absence of written narrative, you know, they're just not as talky. You pick up a comic book from the 90s, especially something that like Louise Simonson wrote.
You're going to dedicate some time to reading.
It's a novel with
decompressed
pictures.
Storytelling versus compressed. Yeah.
And I go back to Webster's point earlier about whether or not that was the author's intent to make it cinematic or the artist's intent, and how much influence does the author have over what the artist draws.
I think you're missing the obvious critic, which would be the editor and the editors and the publishers.
Okay.
I think they probably have more input. They're looking at what's selling and what's not.
Okay.
Movies sell.
But creators do create in that aspect too, because they're under that same pressure. Like,
right. Well, they're answering somebody.
Yep. Yeah.
In the case of like The Ultimates by Mark Millar,
yes.
His scripts were specifically minimal because he wanted that giant 2-page splash where Captain America points to his A on his head and says, "This doesn't stand for France." So there's like those moments, those beats that he writes for.
Yeah.
And he knows that Brian Hitch, this artist, knows that to make it this big, put the focus where I want it, you know?
And what's interesting is like, who was the go-to artist when they did the big album comics? Like the JLA? Was it The Ladder?
Was that Alex called? Ross?
Well, Ross did a bunch of those. Heaven's Ladder was
Heaven's
Brian
Ladder.
Hitch.
Yeah, that was Brian Hitch.
That was Mark Waid and Brian Hitch, yeah.
Very similar, but same approach.
Yeah.
Where they had these, they were giant album-sized comic books. They didn't do them a lot.
Nope.
The Alex Ross did a couple devoted to... But
different Justice League members, Hitch did that one, the Heaven's Ladder, because Hitch was basically at the forefront of that cinematic push.
Yep.
And you would think Alan Davis would have been, because Hitch was a clone of him. Nope, not as much.
Hmm.
Yeah, Alan Davis is a little bit too much of a man of quality.
Yeah,
is the way I'll put it. Yeah. You know,
but I liked the Ultimates for what it was, and I liked the Authority for what it was.
I liked the original Authority for what it was. I want to see the Ultimates burn in hell. But okay,
nobody really talks about those comics anymore, and they were really, really influential there in the early early aughts.
They defined an era.
Yeah,
yeah,
and. I came across Ultimates number one at a thrift store the other day, and it's not going for anything. I remember that was a very, very, very valuable comic book at one time.
Speaking of that, like, I'm curious, you said they were very influential at that time. With the way that like comic books, cinema films and stuff like that are so based off comic books.
Mm-hmm.
How did that, from your guys' opinion, the Ultimates and that early aughts like influence? Like, because...
Specifically...
Because Marvel, like... Well, not Marvel, but just comic book storytelling is, like, peaking right now in a way that it hasn't ever.
In the very specific way, the Ultimates is what casted Sam Jackson as Nick Fury.
True, yeah.
And so the movies were like, they did it for us, let's do it. So in a very specific way, the Ultimates is the birthplace of the Marvel cinematic really universe.
Which is why we had to have the Secret Wars, so we could merge these universes and make them all legit, because it was going to be really too confusing to explain why this universe has got a crusty old white... Nick Fury.
Why do we have David Hasselhoff over here? Hasselhoff over here, and Sam Jackson over here.
And you know what? Miles Morales is a really cool Spider-Man, but you know Peter's cool too. But we don't. Yeah, and trying to explain that to people, it's just going to be too difficult. So we
merged them.
We merged them just like Crisis.
Yep. Oh, universes. Let's talk about you. No.
I need five more beers before we get there.
Yeah, we've got a lot more to go.
Let's talk about this real quick. Okay. So I blew my mind because earlier, before we started recording,
he's a double agent.
Webster had mentioned that it's like, wasn't there like an episode where he like when he woke up, he didn't know if he was not a Barzepticon? I'm like, yeah, because Starscream lied to him.
We're talking about.
Did you just discover that sigil flips?
Well, I thought it had, but then I couldn't figure out how it did, and then I finally made it work.
So there's an audible gasp earlier in the episode because Chris did it, and I was like,
yep.
And then I tried to transform it and stop because I didn't want to break it.
He has this little
flippy plate
in his chest.
Turns Autobot to Decepticon.
Sigil.
I like how this all looks like a spaceman's like air pack suit.
Oh yeah. By the way, we love Jetfire.
Jetfire is amazing.
What gen of Transformer is that?
He is the first gen, but here's the interesting thing. When he was, a lot of the early Transformers were brought over, but they were actually different.
Well, they came over from the old country.
From the old country. they were actually different products that Hasbro bought. So the original Jetfire toy is actually a Macross toy. Mm-hmm. And he looks nothing like a Transformer. So when they made the cartoon, they had to redesign him in a completely different way because they didn't have the rights to represent the toy in the cartoon. So this new toy is based off of the cartoon design, but not off the original toy design.
Gotcha.
Complicated licensing.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to get more into the weeds of how crazy the Transformers are, I recommend the Netflix series The Toys That Made Us.
Yep, it's really
Transformers
good.
Episode is just fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's about it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. I'm going to throw it back to Ben and Chris and Cole and Nicole at the Perfect Bound Podcast proper. And we here at the Stumble Bound, we'll see you some indeterminate time in the future when there's a scheduling snafu and we need to create content. Here you go.
There you go.
Well, I'm sorry you had to listen to that. Those guys are on their lips and taking an Uber home. At least that's what I did. Anyway, let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And
Chris Cassell, let's start with you.
What do you got, Chris?
I was looking at the things that I was going to maybe talk about, and I just want to talk about the new season of She-Ra. and any season of She-Ra, because you should watch them all, like, right now. I absolutely love this show. And Nicole knows, but poor Leanne knows. Leanne doesn't care. But she has to listen to me like, oh, and that happened, and then they did that. But I will focus. So it is by Noelle Stevenson, or she's the showrunner, and that she's the creator of Lumberjanes, and she needs to be given control of more things, period. It is a very, from the heart kind of show that has amazing characters who develop over time. And the villains aren't just straight up like villains with no motivation. Like most of them think they're on the right side. So there's some interesting stories. There's a lot of great LGBT material in there. But this season featured a obscure He-Man villain coming back called Tongue Lashor. And he's a big old snake guy. And he shows up and he's like a punk cowboy Mad Max reject. And it's great because when he shows up, he's like, yes, my name's Tongue Lasher. And like everybody just kind of stops like, that's the name you chose? And he's like, what? And like his henchmen start like laughing. He's like, what? So like stuff like that is pretty amazing. They announced that Kevin Smith's doing He-Man.
Huh?
Kevin Smith's doing
an animated
The new animated He-Man. And like there's a lot of people who complain about the She-Ra, and mostly it's men, and they're like, it's stupid, you know? And it's just kind of like,
because you loved She-Ra before?
Right.
Have you watched old She-Ra?
It's not for you.
My sister did.
You know? And so I'm sure they're happy that Kevin Smith's doing He-Man, and I'm sorry, Kevin Smith seems like a really good person, a nice person, but like Noel Stevenson runs circles around him as far as storytelling and character development. So just putting that out there. And if you were to watch She-Ra, we could talk about it. So,
how do I watch She-Ra? Where is it on?
It's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
It's
okay.
Three seasons, but a season's like 6-7 episodes.
Has it gone to three seasons?
We're on season three now.
Jeez, I'm terrible with watching TV. I think I'm still through like 3/4 through season one. And I like it, and I love the characters, and it just, I'm terrible.
Yeah. It's a new version of She-Ra. It's a different person, and it kind of creates a new mythology. The main villain, Hordak, is interesting because in this third season, they give him a romance story plot. And once you stop and really look at him, you're like, oh my God, you're a sad goth boy. Yeah. And it's like, this is the best thing you could have done with Hordak.
A sad goth boy or a goth boy. Okay, yes.
Yeah, that kind of meets you.
Yeah, that was...
Touché.
Yeah, okay, touché. I highly recommend it. Make some time, watch that. Get your kids to watch it.
Yeah, for sure. It gave life to something. It updated it, and I think it did a really good design, overall character design. Mm-hmm. A good character design overhaul to the 80s cartoon show.
Yes.
And playing with some of the silliness of the costumes and still making them work. I mean, the only thing that I don't like is the way Shadow Weaver is depicted, because just a cloaked woman is just perfectly good in my book. Mm-hmm. And they made her like a weird like totem or something.
She kind of has sort of like a totemish mask.
Yeah.
But I will say that her character is really interesting by season three.
Hmm.
There's some cool stuff about her. So,
nice.
Yes.
That's cool. Because she didn't really get much in the comics. She just was always Hordak's like number two.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
And the main message is that friendship is magic.
Which is
friendship
always.
Is yes.
Always a good message.
Always a good message. Yes. So, yeah.
All right. Cool. She-Ra. You can find it on Netflix. Thank you, Chris. Nicole.
There will be a graphic novel coming out at some point, too.
Yeah, I'm all up about that.
So we'll probably talk about that when that comes out.
Cool.
Whenever it comes
Thanks
out.
For that little tidbit. What do you want to tell us about this week?
Oh, also LGBT material. So I like finding manga that is actually doing LGBT stuff right and not just being like boys love, girls love, though I do read that stuff as well. So I checked out Our Dreams at Dusk by Shimanami Tasugari. Hopefully I didn't butcher that. And story and art by Yuki Kamatani. So I take that as it was probably a light novel first, and then somebody is adapting it, and this happens a lot.
Probably.
And this follows a character named Tasuku Kanami, and he's a new kid in town, and he's also gay. So right off the bat, they don't say like, oh, we're straight boys, and we like kind of like fooling around sometimes, like a lot of yaoi does and a lot of boys love does. This one is like, no, this kid's gay, and he's trying to deal with being in school and being around people, and somebody takes his phone and goes like, oh, you're looking at gay porn, what are you, a homo? And like, he just can't take it, and he gets to a breaking point where he wants to end his life, and he sees somebody across the way who climbs out of a window and just leaps out, and he's like, oh my God, what is this, what's going on? So he runs over to the place, and it just seems to be like a drop-in place, and he's like, there's someone, and then the person comes out, and he's like, well, what happened, like I thought you jumped. And they go, oh, that's someone-san is who they call her, someone, and they say someone because they don't actually know her name. And so someone-san says, you should come into my room or something. Someone's like, what? Come into her room? Like, nobody ever lets, like, she never lets anybody do that. So he comes into the room, and she says, like, so you wanted to kill yourself, huh? Look, I'll listen to you. You can talk to me, but I won't listen to you. And you have, like, 10 minutes or something like that. And he's like, what, you know? But what it is that she's doing, she's done this with multiple people, that she is somebody who will not listen because that means that you can tell whatever you want to her she's not going to remember it. You get it off your chest, and maybe you can find some self-acceptance for yourself and move on in your life. So it seems like a very cold, like aloof thing to do, and she is very aloof, but it actually works for people. And this drop-in place, she has all these, it's a town that the population has dwindled to the point where nobody's really living in a lot of the houses, and so there's these projects and nonprofits around town that renovate the places and make them into other places. And Someone-san has a lot of money. We don't know why, but she's scooping up all these places and having people renovate them and turn them into things like this, like drop-in cafe where people can just come and hang out. So it's following Tasuku and like him coming to terms with being gay and like slowly coming out to people and finding his people and his village as his, you know, his group of friends, kind of a support system. The second volume focuses on this one kid that is coming through towards the end of the manga who just crosses paths with Tasuku, says like a one line and is off, and Tezuka's like, who is this kid? And like at the end it's just like, oh, so you are a homo, huh? And that's just like, who's this kid? What, where are you? Like, I even went back through the manga to be like, is this kid with us, is he like in the classroom or something like that? So it's focusing on Tezuku who's gay, and then the next one is about someone who's trans, and it's just this overarching thing of these people coming to terms with being LGBT. And I think it's even though in 2019, we're not necessarily looking for coming out stories and people having to overcome the hardships of being gay. I think that this being in the context of it's a Japanese manga and there is such a stigma and such a, like, you're going to let your family down if you can't go and have a family and have kids, you know, if you're gay, that just kind of, it puts shame on your family just because your family knows it's going to be harder for you and they don't want that for you. They want you to be the most successful that you can be. And so that's just going to be like tarnishing you. And so there's a lot of people who struggle with that in this book of like, do I tell my parents? Do I not tell my parents? What's going to happen to me? You know, that it's hard to get jobs, you know, and they even talk about like sexual harassment in the workplace and all different types of stuff. So it does do a really good job. And I think for what it is, I'm really excited to read more of it and have more like this and hopefully get to the point where we have like Noelle Stevenson gay She-Ra kind of stuff coming out in manga form that's not so much about girls just wanting to read manga about cute boys kissing who, you know, they're straight until they're not, you know, and actually have some really compelling LGBT material. So it's $12.99. I like the illustrations and the story was extremely compelling. So I would definitely recommend it. It's kind of a strange title. Our Dreams at Dusk. It's very literary, fluttery, but it is very good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Mm-hmm. And finally, Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
Well, I picked up one of Dark Horse's hardbound editions of illustrated Neil Gaiman stories. This one's called The Problem of Susan and Other Stories, and it features four Neil Gaiman short stories, two illustrated by P. Craig Russell, another by Scott Hampton, and a third by Paul Chadwick. I really like these editions. I can't always afford them. For a while there, they were doing that. They were just standalone stories that were lengthy or perhaps novellas. And I think there was a series of them that were all drawn by Michael Zulli. And then there have been a bunch of them that by P. Craig Russell. I think that Coraline was broke up into two books.
Two books.
And the Graveyard book.
Graveyard book was two books.
Was
yeah.
two books. Okay. I don't have any of those just because money. But, you know, I'm so happy when I do buy these because I, as y'all know, he's my favorite writer. And what Dark Horse does successfully is when they adapt his stories in these type of collections with these high-end artists, they never detract, they only enhance the stories. And this one, the story of the lead story, The Problem of Susan and Other Stories, or excuse me, The Problem of Susan, period, is one of Gaiman's better kind of postmodern stories because it's the story of the elder sister Susan from the Narnia Chronicles. And she is the only one that gasp, if you read all the way to the last battle, Susan is the only one who survives. And her and the story of, you know, what became of her in the real world. And it's very heartbreaking, but it's beautifully rendered by Russell. But this collection is going to hold a particular place in my heart because at the very end, it adapts one of my favorite poems by Gaiman called The Day the Saucers Came, illustrated by Paul Chadwick, who, in my humble opinion, we just don't get to see enough of anymore. And Paul, we really need new concrete stories. So get done with the video game writing and come back to concrete, please, because I miss that stuff a lot. And I think you don't realize how much your fan base misses you, and the world needs a concrete story. So
thanks for listening to our podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. We know you're up there up north in Glen Ellum or wherever you are.
He's local?
Yeah, he's local.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. He's a really, really great guy. I used to talk with him at comic cons and you know I had to pull myself away because I enjoyed talking to him.
My
so
cousin
much.
Lives in Clee Ellum. I wonder.
I don't think it's Clee Ellum. But it is north of
Roslyn or something.
Somewhere up there.
North.
Yeah,
north Canada.
Getting close there. I do. It may even be Bellingham. I don't remember. But thoroughly enjoyed this collection. It came out in January. It retails it for $17.99. I found it used, so I was kind of happy.
Nice.
Cool. The Problem of Susan.
Yes.
Dot. And other stories.
And other stories.
All I think of is the Tick, and there's like the alien whose name is Thrakazog, and mm-hmm. Tick's just like 3X and a dog. And he's like, Susan. The monster's like, no, you're doing it on purpose.
All right, cool. Well, thank you, Cole. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, where our latest episode, Say It Loud, is probably, hopefully, now online for everybody's enjoyment, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your comics at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And our friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Chris Casso. Lay it on us, Chris.
So this one's about inter-franchise crossovers. And even though Archie doesn't show up anywhere, I couldn't think of a good name for it, so I just called it Just Throw Archie in It. Because he's kind of been everywhere. He's the town bicycle. In the actually pretty good crossover between Star Trek and Transformers, Captain Kirk reanimated the starship-sized Fortress Maximus with his own willpower, resulting in a new iteration of the character that they named what?
I just bought this from you, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay. Fortress Tiberius.
Aww.
Nice.
Yes, I want that toy. Published in 1993, this comic book crossover was actually adapted from a 1992 television commercial for Nike. The comic was written by Mike Baron with art by Jeff Butler and Keith Eichen, and saw two giants of their respective fields clash in a different locale, California instead of Tokyo, and introduced a magic silver dollar to move the plot along since the commercial is like 30 seconds long. What is this comic?
Godzilla versus Charles Barkley?
Yeah. It has one of the best panels ever where Godzilla has a slam dunk and it just says Godzilla got busy.
Good lord.
Yep, it was a thing.
Oh,
yeah.
I want that.
Also published in 1993, The Ren and Stimpy Show number 6 featured a colossal battle of champions as Spider-Man has to fight the mind-controlled Powdered Toast Man. Featuring many tongue-in-cheek callbacks to Spider-Man tropes, this issue was written by someone who would later write a 10-year run of Spider-Man and become a core writer of the Marvel Universe with many successful runs.
Brian Michael Bendis?
No.
Was it Slott?
Dan Slott.
What?
Yeah. Dan Slott started early with Spider-Man on Ren and Stimpy.
Wow.
Yeah. Currently being published between DC and IDW, the current iteration of Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles features a multiversal mishmash story called Crisis in a Half Shell that features such amalgamated characters. It's good, isn't it?
Good.
Amalgamated characters like the Laughing Man, a hybrid of the Shredder and Joker. It also features one of my favorite amalgamations where they take the villain Krang and shove him into the stomach of what DC character? It's so good.
Ooh.
Ooh. Stomach?
Bane?
Who's a big old piece of armor that likes to start crises?
Is that Darkseid? No, I don't know. I don't know Crisis
Monitor?
Man.
The Anti-Monitor.
The Anti-Monitor. Yeah.
They have a giant Anti-Monitor with a Krang in his stomach.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Yeah. Okay, last one. Archie Sonic Super Special issue number 7 features a series of bizarre crossovers as the book starts with a character being interviewed by two FBI agents named Skulder and Molly. The story features a villain named Dr. Ian Droid, who wants to use a master emerald from the Sonic universe to cause a crisis of infinite realities. Most of the story takes place on the Earth of the Image universe, where which characters take part in the madness that is this crossover? Just name a couple.
Savage Dragon.
There you go.
Spawn.
Yep, there you go.
Ripclaw.
I don't know if he... Yeah, no, he was there. Yeah. Union, Savage Dragon, the
Brick.
Max. Maybe not Brick. And Shadowhawk. Also, you can see in the shadows Batman, Spider-Man, and Popeye in Dr. Ian Droid's prison cells. Hmm. And it's also worth mentioning that the Sonic character Knuckles, the Echidna, punches reality so hard that everything gets fixed, a move that Superboy Prime would steal later for the Infinite Crisis event.
Is that right?
Wow.
Cool. Well, that is Chris Iam. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for listening. And thank you at the table. We did it!
Oh,
we survived today. Woo. We will see you next week.